Hello, Toby Haydock here, and it's my sad duty to have hastily put this, as it turns out, posthumous Who's Round together with a lady who let me into her home less than 6 months ago. I've carried on doing the odd Who's Round if people I couldn't get in the year 2013 were still up for doing it. And this lady originally agreed to take part and then got diagnosed with cancer and couldn't. And when she was feeling up to it the following year, she kindly took me into her home. And as I'm sure you're all aware, Linda passed away yesterday as I record this. So before we go into part one of what we'll do, a two-part interview, I'd like to direct you to Action on Cancer, www.actiononcancer.org. I normally do the charity at the end, but before you go ahead and listen to this, please donate to www.actiononcancer.org, which is the charity that Linda wanted to benefit from her giving her time to me, as she did a few short months ago. Anyway, over to that day, and rest in peace, Linda. Oh, well, it's a beautiful sunny day in a top-secret location in London. And I'm delighted, always, especially to get somebody that wasn't on the DVD of the story that they covered. But we've just had a brilliant conversation already. But we're now going to start officially as I ask my guest to tell me who she is and why I'm talking to her about Doctor Who.
Hooray! I'm Linda Bellingham, and I played the Inquisitor in the Trial of the Time Lord series when Colin Baker was Doctor Who. 13 episodes, and I have to say, deeply upset that I was never asked to return, especially as I am a Time Lord.
Well, the Time Lords have just been saved in a pocket universe, so it's possible you might return.
It's the story of my life, see? Be saved in a pocket universe. But, no, it was... And at the time, I mean, it's always been popular and it's always had its... But, it, of course, it hadn't reached the heights that it's reached now, but it was one of those programmes that you could tick off your bucket list, you know, and especially as a mother then, I'll get some credibility because you can do all sorts of things that mean nothing to your family. And the fact that I did Doctor Who, I suddenly had street cred.
But you talk about its popularity. It had just come back off hiatus. It had been taken off by Michael Grade and sort of brought back and told to smarten up its act. So were you aware that you were on a show that it was about a trial, but it was also on trial itself?
I wasn't really, except that lovely... Now, because I also... This is a little sort of... I don't know how much gossip is involved here.
Oh, as much as you like.
Nathan
Turner.
Nathan Turner. There we go. I got the job because I was then married to my second husband, an Italian restaurateur, and we had a restaurant called Bianco's in Muswell Hill, bottom of Muswell Hill. And John Nathan Turner was a great friend of an actress called Anita Graham, and who was marvellous, completely off the wall, mad as a box of frogs. And she and I were doing a play in the West End with David Jason called Look No Hants. Very, very intellectual piece, as you can imagine. But we were at the Old Witch, and I had my name in big lights. It was Michael Codron produced it, so it was all proper. But anyway, it was as this business is... Anita had her birthday party in the restaurant, and so there was lots of people. And bizarrely, I was sitting next to John Nathan Turner, not knowing anything about who he was or anything else. And suddenly, in the middle of the meal, he said to me, "Do you reckon you could be a dramatic actress?" Which actually really irritated me. And I thought, "Oh, you're obviously not my kind." You know, I said, "Yes, I do drama." You know, and don't forget, this is post Oxo, which mm-hmm. was the worst thing I ever did for my career, really, but still. I said, "Yes, absolutely, you know." And he said, "Because I think I've got a marvellous part for you." And the next thing was Doctor Who. But then apparently he upset lots of people, didn't he? Or there was poor Colin. When I recently did a DVD...
Was it a Big Finish CD?
Yes, a Big Finish CD. We were talking about the press, and poor Colin had a right old run-in with the... with the tabloids or with the News of the World or the People, or it, because he was made to look as though he was
It was the Daily Star, which ran a story about John Nathan Turner with a very incendiary headline,
but a picture of John Nathan Turner and Colin.
Involving Colin, that's right, which really upset
So somebody glancing at it would have seen Doctor Who incendiary stuff and assumed it was Colin.
Exactly.
And they knew exactly what they were doing.
Exactly. So, but at the time, I suppose it was all about me dying. I was just so thrilled that suddenly I'd got a chance to come back and do something, you know, interesting for a change. Although, then, of course, when the reality of it struck was that I walked in episode one with a great fanfare into the court, sat down and never moved again for the entire 13 episodes, where at the end of episode 13 I got up and walked out again, you know, and I had visions of time-lording it all over the place and running around and doing things. But no, listen, I'm still part of it.
Well, it's interesting, because you have alluded to, the nature of the role. How do you get nuance, I guess? How do you keep it interesting for yourself if, as you say, through every block, your courtroom scenes, by their nature, are exposition-y, and you don't get a different different location or new blood?
Yeah, but except I think what saved it, why I was really lucky, was to have Michael Jayston and Colin, because they're both consummate actors. Colin and I had worked together before that on a tour when he was married to Lisa Goddard. And so we had a kind of, you know, a shorthand anyway. And so, you know, you enjoyed playing off the actors. And even if we took the mickey sometimes, it gave it... Because there's a need, you'll know this, the energy that you need in a scene, any scene, on television especially, you can't... On stage, it's easier to see. You know, you come on, you've got this energy, you carry the play through for 2.5 hours, and it's very much in the hands of the actor. You know, nobody. But any other media, let's be honest, the director, certainly film, it's down. A director can make or break you, can make a very bad actor look very good. And television's kind of betwixt and between. But my feelings are that even if the script isn't very good, if you've got an energy there, people will watch. And so however you create that energy sometimes, it might not be entirely about the actual script, but you need to have that energy. And for me, you know, having been brought up on Doctor Who and understanding the position of a Time Lord, at the end of the day, I would always bring it back to the fact that I was a Time Lord, I was rather important, and there is something rather magical about them. And I'm not just an ordinary, you know, I'm not just a common or garden criminal justice court JP or old judge or whatever. I was, you know, and I liked the fact that they'd made her a woman, because actually they it was very much a man's world, really, you know, apart from the assistant, who by nature of the beast is the assistant, the girl, you know, and often actresses had to make her more interesting than perhaps she might have been originally. So for me, it was great to be the lady in charge of these two rather naughty schoolboys.
And, well, you mentioned directors. I mean, did the different directors bring a different energy? You had Nick Mallet did the first, Ron Jones the second, Chris Clough the third.
That's
block.
Right.
Did they bring different energies or ask you different things of you?
Yes, and I think that's another interesting point about any series, or is that you look to the outside, don't you? I mean, people have said this, that when I did The Bill, for instance, you go in, the actors who've been in it for 20 years, like, and in soaps, will always be pleased to have somebody come in and challenge them, because it's hard to when they're doing their stories or everyday stories. So there you have a trial with all its nuances and all its... And so each director is obviously, first of all, coming in because they want to sell themselves. It's all about them, you know, and how they visualise it. But they're to a level, that to a degree, they're limited by the overall look of the piece. But yes, you'd get a feel. Chris Clough, I particularly remember, because again, he had a very similar sense of humour, very similar take on, you know, stuff, and we were able to talk. And if you did tend to get stuck in a bit stodgy and a bit, you know, you needed to be able to trust somebody to turn around and say, actually, you're being a bit boring, Linda. You know, a lot of it, as you say, was exposition, and a lot of it, the shot sometimes would be, is that listening thing, which is really hard for actors to do. And for an audience, even if they're not aware of it, it's not that you want to impose yourself on them, but the audience has got to believe that you are staying with it and that you are part of the action, even though you're not up and down and doing things. So it was important to have people to remind you of that. And also to keep referring to the action that was going on, that I wasn't seeing. You know, you get sidelined in your little court bit, and then you miss the overall. You must get a good director will keep you in the picture with the overall feel of the thing.
And you didn't know how it was going to end when you started, so you were I guess you were asked to show in the first four scripts or something, and
that's right, yeah. and you carry on
hoping you'll stand up. So hoping yes, you read the stage direction and the visitor stands up.
Rather hoping, yes. but yes, you are absolutely led. You're in the hands of the script writers, and you do, I mean, that's always the way, isn't it? I mean, life's like that in a funny way, isn't it? Which is why I suppose, as I say, if there's some kind of, as an actor, as long as you've got some kind of reality at the beginning and a point of a jump off point for your character, they can. I mean, life takes you lots of different ways. It doesn't necessarily follow to suit your personality. You know, let's have her go down this road because she's a sunny little soul and she'll like this. So you would automatically go wherever they send you.
And as somebody that's done so many different things, how do you feel? I mean, some people... I mean, how is it a bit odd or unnerving or even annoying that Doctor Who is something that constantly returns when you've done so many other things?
Yeah, well, I'd rather have Doctor Who than Oxo. I mean, that is, you talk about annoying, that look, I'd like to think I could say I have no regrets, OK? But I do, really. Now I'm older. I mean, I made a terrible mistake. Well, not terrible mistake. The comedy thing was probably the biggest mistake I made, that I went from Fat Nurse Hilda Price, good character part in the first daytime soap, General Hospital. Somebody came up to me and said, you obviously have a great feel for comedy. Will you come and do this series with Jimmy Tarbuck? And I saw names like Josephine Tewson and Hugh Paddock, proper, good, solid, and thought, oh, how marvellous, and was led up this terrible alley, which ended with Confessions of a Driving Instructor. Not realising at the time that... And it's funny, I've just done I've contributed to a documentary that Channel 4 are doing about the 70s and how unpolitically correct it was. But it's true that as a girl, you were completely a foil for the men. And in comedy, you were only perceived like a dirty postcard, you know, seaside postcard. And so that whole thing... And for John Nathan Turner to turn around and say, can you do straight acting? And in a bizarre way, my 70s... It took me right through to the end of the 70s to realise my mistake. Nobody took me seriously. You know, there's a very snobby thing in the theatre, the Royal Shakespeare and the National and places. If you're flat-chested and wear a dirty white T-shirt, you're taken seriously. And Linda LaPlante, who was then an actress, Linda Marchal, and I used to laugh about it, that because we had boobs, nobody would ever take us. And because we'd done comedy, nobody would ever take us seriously. And then I worked my way back to some kind of normality, because in 1979 I did a thing called Mackenzie for the BBC, which was an Andrea Newman series, which was all very, you know, serious and marvellous. Got going again. Then, in 1983, got offered the Oxo commercials. Well, you know, it was money. It was a lot of money. You can say, on the one hand, it gave me the chance to do all sorts of things. I did a one-woman show at the King's Head. I did all sorts of plays that I couldn't have afforded to do if I hadn't had that money coming in. And you didn't know when you took it that it was going to last 16 years. But what I was left with was this legacy of nice mumsy mum. And I kept saying to people, but, you know, Lady Macbeth was a mum. For God's sake, she doesn't just have to be seen smiling benignly. But again, I suffered for it. And so things... The whole Doctor Who thing, if I look back now, because when was... It was 80... When was Trial of a Time
Lord? Look at 86.
86, yes. So, you see, that was great for me, that in the mid... Anything that... Because I'd got All Creatures Great and Small then happened. But anything that took me away from that whole Oxo thing, and I kept thinking, this'll do it, this'll break them all. And for some reason, it didn't. And I never quite found... the role that we all look for as an actor, let's be honest. If you look at everybody, the Brenda Blethyns, the Julia Walters, the Helen Mirrens, it's one role that sets you off and away you go. Unfortunately, if it's an Oxo commercial, you know, you're stuck with that, really.
Well, interesting, because to John Nathan Turner's credit, actually, despite the ham-fisted way in which he did it, at the time, and interesting that television is supposed to be creative, it's a very conservative medium in terms of the people that put things on, and they have a very
and
small
lazy,
umbrella.
Actually.
Yes, very. In that John, you know, Doctor Who is the only programme in the 80s where you would have seen William Gaunt in leather with a machine gun as a mercenary,
yes.
You know, or yourself as a space.
You needed
in,
that,
in that John quite liked casting people well known for something else in a different environment.
And that's absolutely how it should be. And you look at American television now and how it's taken off, they do exactly that. They give people a chance. They take and they take people and put them in and use them as actors. And when you look at the fantastic typing pool of character actors, and I always saw myself as a character actor, we had, and they were always underused and never brought to the fore, and we didn't write enough of those sort of parts. And then, of course, it went into... Well, the 90s was all about just putting faces from soap operas into television series that they weren't suitable for, or signing them up and paying them vast amounts of money. I mean, no disrespect to Ross Kemp, but, you know, he's found his métier now, if you like, but to pay him thousands of pounds and then put him in a serial about a solicitor because they have to find something to... because they've paid for him... Crazy stuff, you know, and everybody else suffered from it. Nobody else then got paid proper money. The shows weren't successful. And again, credit to John Nathan Turner, that I do think that television executives have lost a lot of respect for their audiences. I think they're patronising, and I think they pander to a tiny minority, whereas the majority of people are actually quite bright and don't want rubbish and don't like being talked down to, and they get pushed aside.
But it's funny you should say that, because you talk... I mean, I remember when you were in The Bill, where you played cracking part and you did it brilliantly. And I remember thinking, gosh, she's good, because I know her as a... And I don't use this word pejoratively, as a personality, because you'd started presenting stuff or appearing on yourself,
yeah.
Things. I thought, so you've done that, which must, I think, when you choose to do that as an actor, is a risky manoeuvre. But she's now got this part, and it's not just a couple of episodes of The Bill. You're the sort of running through villain, and they've given you some really good stuff, and and it's completely against the image that you had portrayed up till that point.
But you see, listen to this, Toby. See now, and this The Bill we're talking 10 years ago now. Now apparently it's okay for your personality, because they tell you it's all about branding, don't they? Well, an actor, how could you ever ask an actor to be a brand? Because we are whatever the part we're playing. We wouldn't call it a brand, but they might call it a brand. Unfortunately, I think, and I'm not, oh, poor me, but I managed to sit on the wrong side of all this timing, that it did me badly. Because what should have happened after The Bill is that I should have then gone back to being an actor. But nothing happened, and I'll be absolutely honest now, that the same with OXO and the same after Loose Women, suddenly there are, I don't care what anybody says, nobody offers you a job. And I actually went to see the head of, I went to see Peter Fincham at ITV, and I went to see Danny
Cohen,
yeah. Thank you, from above, at the BBC. I took myself off to see them and asked them why I wasn't employed. And certainly with ITV, having basically been loyal to them on and off for 30-odd years. And Peter Fincham's reply was, well, you know, that's the price you pay when you do something like Loose Women. And I said, but I'm sorry, nowadays it's about having a profile. And if you've got a profile, you use the profile. And if and it was the same when the OXO commercials happened. If you looked at ratings and things, apparently, I was a very, very popular person. People really liked to watch me. Well, then logically it should follow that if you give me a series, people will watch me in that series. Nobody ever would ever give me a series. I know I did the comedy, I did Faith in the Future, I did Second Thoughts. But again, it's comedy, you see. And having done comedy, nobody then put you in a drama. So Peter Fincham said, I'm sorry, but let's have you back on Loose Women. And I said, no, I don't want to go back on Loose Women. I've done Loose Women. I've done that. I want to go back into... I said, why can't you... I said, I'll tell you what then. I'll do Loose Women for a year if you give me a series. Give me something. Give me a Murder, She Wrote type thing. That's the... I'm not asking people to accept me as some great heroine, but... And he just said, well, you know, I'm sorry, it's not how... And Danny Cohen greeted me as, oh, you know, you're a nation's treasure, my mother loves you. And again, I said, so? And he said, well, by the time the job gets to me, it's already been cast and you know, it's a done deal. And I said, yeah, but you could go to a production company and say, I happen to like Linda Bellingham, but I just, obviously, it was never going to be in my remit for some reason. I couldn't quite inspire people to go that extra mile. But it's slightly annoying, because if you are, people either like you or they don't, and if they like you, they turn on and watch you.
But it's interesting to hear you talk like that, because from an outsider and from a performer, you know, I'd look at you and go, gosh, she doesn't stop, she's never out of work. It's always a different picture, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And did you have misgivings? Because I occasionally get asked to. I did something on This Morning the other day. You do it for the money.
Yeah.
But I sort of go, but then if a casting director sees that, is he then going to give me a job? So, you know, it's that eternal problem, isn't it?
Well, if you sit with people who go, actors especially, who should know better, oh, for goodness sake. Or critics go, well, goodness knows why they took that job. Sorry, you have to survive.
Got two
you
kids.
Yes, you have a huge, huge choice to make. Don't you? Right from day one, when you leave drama school, there are actors I could who never got anywhere, who would refuse to compromise, and who would sit in their bedsitter and speak to them and talk to themselves, basically. Because an actor, you can't. It's unfortunately one of those arts. You need an audience. You need people to see you to do it, and it shouldn't be like this. But in order to live. Now, interestingly enough, it was much, much easier, as my son's an actor now. It's much harder. In the 70s, you could go to rep, you could work in rep for five, as long as you liked, but, you know, actually you had to do 42 weeks before you got an equity card, before you were allowed to do a commercial or television. So you had to go and work in the theatre, and there was work to be had in the theatre. It also sorted the men from the boys and the wheat from the chaff. If you weren't prepared to get out and give it some welly and earn £9 a week at Frinton-on-Sea, which is what I did, then don't be in this game. And then in the 70s, you'd earn really nothing, but then you'd get the odd commercial, which would be your bit. Or you'd get an episode of Minder or The Professionals. And actually, that would just about get you through a year, though, so you could pay the rent and live. You know, a couple of tellies. And it didn't... The commercials didn't upset your career because you were on, you know... They weren't big enough to. They weren't like big campaigns, and that's how you survived. And eventually, you hoped that you'd work your way up and be either the supporting actor in a series or get that break.
Yeah. Whereas now, I mean, the rep is, I guess, the
where is it?
Soap.
It's soap. But then again, you see how hard it must be to be in a soap, and start off your life, and then after two or three years, you've got the recognition, you've got a regular income to make that break. And, of course, you always live to your wage, unfortunately. Well, actors do, don't they?
Yeah,
who knows an actor who's ever saved a penny in their lives? So then you're actually, when they do suddenly decide that it's over, you're left with... Well, no, I'm sure you're better off, you know, if you've been sensible, a bit sensible, and got a roof over your head. But in the main, it's not like you're rolling in... And certainly not these days you're not rolling in cash.
No.
I mean, and an average wage on an episode of, I don't know, if you go into a running serial or series, is about the same as I got paid when I was doing All Creatures Great and Small. And the repeat fees, not like America, is it, where, you know, you watch Alibi all day long and Gold and endless reruns for you get tuppence.
Yeah, they get nothing.
And I've got a best friend who's a makeup girl, and she still, I don't think her wages have increased ever in 40 years.
Yeah.
And yet they do, you know, 18-hour days. Oh, and it's always the same with any kind of, but it's highlighted in our industry. There's always somebody standing behind you who's going to do it. When they tried to have the strike, you remember the voiceover strike, and it was Stephen Burkoff. Yes, you know. Oh, him who shouts all day long about people's rights and all the rest of it, dropped us all in it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not good.
Not naughty Stephen Burkoff. You mentioned drama school, so what was it always going to be drama school? Were you always going to act? What was the impetus?
Always. And it's always difficult, isn't it, when you talk about... I hate actors talking about acting, because nobody will ever understand, and you shouldn't... Because there's an arrogance. It's a very weird... One half of me is just knew that that's all I wanted to do. Well, I had a brief moment where I wanted to be a show jumper when I was 10, and I got this pony, Tiddlywinks. I had a brief moment I wanted to be Pat Smythe. She was a very famous, but it was quite theatrical. But then I got hay fever when I was 12, so that was no good. And then I did an outdoor theatre, Pendley Shakespeare Festival near Tring in Hertfordshire, and played Puck, and that was it, as far as I was concerned. That. And in my head, it was just never, ever, ever, never did it occur to me that I was not going to succeed, and I wanted to be the greatest actress and be worldwide famous. But it's not famous like now. I wanted to be the greatest actress, but obviously I would be famous and known throughout the world because I'd be up there with Elizabeth Taylor and, you know, I'd be... But it's that not that I want to be famous for the sake of being famous. I knew I'd be famous because I'd be such a wonderful actress. Never occurred to me that I would not succeed. This is the point. And yet, as a person, absolutely riddled with insecurities, which is why I went into comedy probably more than anything, mm-hmm. is that because in the 70s you were either the pretty girl who played the lead or you were the friend, you know, you were the fat friend. And so, bizarrely, when you did comedy and they put you in a blonde wig and an uplift bra, somehow they made you this... And then I found I'd got this, oh, well, you're a bit sexy, aren't you? No, that's a character part. You know, it's not got nothing to do with me, but I could hide behind those sort of parts in a way that I would have found it actually very difficult. If I'd been given the lead in a drama playing somebody who supposedly was very attractive and was sexy and you know, like a leading lady has to be, really. She has to be all those things. You know, there has to be a magnetism about her as a woman and physically. And I was never going to be thin enough to look thin on camera. And I knew my limitations, so I knew that I'd have to go down a different road. But at the same time, it never occurred to me that I wouldn't make it. And that I would do that for the rest of my life.
But it's interesting what you say about comedy, because obviously I do think that comedy is slightly looked down upon
in
some way, which is bizarre because you do it sort of thing.
Yeah.
But by the other token, if you had maybe gone into classical theatre and done all of that early on, might you not have 20, 30 years later been going, oh, I wish I'd done the odd sitcom?
Probably. I mean, maybe. It's an interesting... It is just the frustration. I used to have long conversations with James Bolam about it when we were doing Second Thoughts, because Jimmy very much wanted to be taken seriously as a serious actor and had been brought up through Birmingham Rep with all those heavy directors. And I think he was a bit bitter, necessarily, but miffed that he was...
Grumpy.
Yeah. because he did, you know, the series of the Likely Lads.
The Likely Lads, yeah.
He got that image, and you know, it is so much harder to make people laugh. You know, you do, having done drama in the theatre. Yes, if it's really bad, an audience will shuffle and cough, and you know it's not going well. But in the main, you know, they'll sit through. They'll take a lot more in a drama than they will in a comedy because they just don't laugh. Mm. And there's these gaping holes, you know. And you know this. When I was doing... In my 4 years of Calendar Girls, when I'd work with however many different casts, it never was it more apparent to me, you cannot teach. You cannot teach comedy. You either have timing or you don't. Now, within that, the next thing is, if you're not real... And one of my... Actually, where it changed comedy in the 90s, and then it seeped into drama, no disrespect, but a stand-up comic, as you saw them coming out of the 90s, there are rhythms that you speak in and deliver lines, which is great for stand-up, but it's not acting.
I agree.
And Ronnie Barker had it and nailed it, you just hear the rhythms all the time in people that have come from stand-up. They always, all their characters all speak in the same way. You know what I mean? You deliver it. And it annoys me because that became a method of acting that actually is not acting. And so situation comedy lost its lost its appeal, I think, because people were doing it and delivering a line. Instead of being that character, there's the banana skin, along comes your character. Depending on how well you've created your character, the audience anticipates you slipping on that banana skin. You don't just fall on a banana skin and expect to get a laugh. No. It's a massively complex, and having the tragedy as well, and so it's, I've never understood why, and you never see people win Oscars for comedy, do you?
No.
Same old, same old. So once you're stuck with it, you're stuck with it. So I probably haven't left enough time now, sadly, but I basically wanted to win an Oscar, aged about 75, for Best Newcomer. For something funny, because I thought then I could stand up and have my say.
Well, it could still happen.
Well, you never know.
And sadly, as we now know, that wasn't the case. There wasn't time. But Linda wanted to benefit the charity Action on Cancer. So www.actiononcancer.org. We'll put part two of this out at a later date. In the meantime, thanks for listening. And thanks to Linda and to her husband, Michael, who's very much in my thoughts, and hopefully all of our thoughts today. Goodbye.
Slight tilt in axis suggests a spaceship. Or a space station. In orbit around a larger... No! This is an outrage.
Greetings, Doctor.
Madam Inquisitor, I protest.
Frequently, yes.
But he's me. A future version of me. Are you telling me that the Time Lords revisited their own time stream and rewrote the law?
Recorders, delete that last section of transcript. Doctor, compose yourself.
He's either a future version of me or he's something else.
Doctor, we meet again.